What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
On August 16th, 2029, U.S. Army leases on thousands of acres of Hawaii land will expire. Secured for $1 in 1964, the U.S. military has been in an extractive dynamic with Hawaii and is now seeking to renew the leases on their terms. Indigenous Hawaiians and other residents are fighting back. Joining us to discuss are Camille Kalama, Executive Director of Honua, a non-profit organization dedicated to reclaiming and providing cultural space for the people to learn, practice, engage in Hawaiian traditions and practices, and a longtime advocate for Native Hawaiian rights and self-determination in Hawaii. Also joining us are Kyle Kajihiro, Professor of Ethnic Studies at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. His research focuses on U.S. imperial formations, militarization, and indigenous and decolonial social movements in Hawaii and the Pacific region. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Aloha. Thank you for having us.
Oh, it's my honor and my privilege. I just want to let my listeners know, so while it's early for me, that's my mumble mouth, it is even earlier for y'all. It is 5 a.m. in Hawaii. So thank you for getting up so early. Kyle, I see you have your coffee. I have mine too. So hopefully my pronunciation will get better as we go through. I do want to just take a minute and honor humanity. How are both you and your families doing with the storms? Is everybody okay?
Yeah, our family is okay. We're fortunate, but our next door neighbors weren't as fortunate. They were hit pretty hard with the flooding. Just a few, I don't know when that was now, maybe 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, early March. Mm-hmm. Kyle?
Yeah, thanks for asking. We're okay in our neighborhood. Usually this area gets some flooding, but we were thankfully spared. But just up the hill in Manoa, they had cars floating down the street. So it's just wild, the variation between different parts of the island.
Yeah, I was on Big Island when it started and then Oahu for the second half of it. And so where I was on the island was fine. But of course, North Shore and other areas underwater. We're going to cover that hopefully next week. All right, on to the topic for today. However, I'm guessing for a lot of my listeners, this is a new issue for them. I'm also guessing that for a lot of my folks, they view Hawaii as just another state in the United States, as opposed to a sovereign nation being illegally occupied. For the purposes of this conversation, we're going to talk about Hawaii as a sovereign nation being illegally occupied by the colonial United States powers. And because that's the framework, then I think we need to start with some context and go back to the beginning of the occupation. So the U.S. military controls roughly 254,000 acres across Hawaii, making it the most militarized state per capita in the nation. On Oahu alone, the military occupies 86,000 acres, or 25% of the island. These lands were part of so-called ceded territories illegally seized from the Hawaiian kingdom. And you all can just signal to each other who's gonna take first lead, and then the other person will have an opportunity to add in what they would like. But Camille, I'm gonna start with you and ask you to take my listeners to the overthrow of Queen Liliuokalani in 1893.
Sure, I'm actually wearing a picture of her.
Oh, yeah, you are.
So she was it was a constitutional monarchy at that time. We had a kingdom that began in 1843. And so by 1893, there was a lot of pressure from American business people here who were interested in controlling the land and the resources. And so by 1893, they had staged an overthrow of the queen. It seized power and put her in prison. And I think people often don't realize that the vast majority of the Hawaiian population at that time opposed annexation by the United States. They were not seeking to be a part of it. Instead, there were many treaties with the United States and other countries around the world. And Hawaii was actually part of the family of nations at that time. And so when the U.S. military in Honolulu Harbor supported the overthrow of our queen, the people came out in force and signed petitions opposing that annexation, and that those petitions are what we stand on in part, as well as the Queen's, the way that she yielded her authority to the United States at that time. She was very careful not to cede her territory. And so we always say, you know, stolen lands or unceded territories, because she was very careful in her language of yielding her authority until such time as the United States would do an investigation and determine that the sovereignty of Hawaii had been illegally taken. And in fact, the investigator sent by the U.S. at that time, James Blount, he found exactly that, the act of taking the kingdom from her was an illegal act and that our sovereignty should be restored. But the president at that time, he lost power, and the next president commissioned a new study and did not complete the return of sovereignty to our people. And so that started, you know, decades of what became eventually a territory and then a so-called state in 1959, when the choice to become, you know, whether Hawaii wanted to become a state was the question of, do you want to be a territory, remain a territory, or become a state? There was no question, do you want your sovereignty back? Do you want to go back to being an independent nation? And so there's a lot of misunderstanding around that as well. But in the process, the U.S. government, you know, took control of many hundreds of thousands of acres of land. And that is where we're dealing with today. But over time, it became the seizure, then condemnations during World War II, and then leases after statehood. And so the leases are what we're talking about now, which is about 40-some thousand acres of land within the whole that the military controls in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the number that I got from the article then was off. Thank you for the correction.
Oh, well, no, the 250, that is like what the military seized, you know, and okay. Leases. So it includes okay. The lease. Yeah.
The federal land, too. Okay, and we're going to get to that. Kyle, I want you to contribute. Will you add into your contributions why Hawaii for U.S. military is a place strategically that they would fiercely want to hold on to?
Yeah, exactly. I think one fact I think is important to understand is how the overthrow of the Queen, the overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom, was the first United States overseas regime change, where a sovereign country had their government overthrown to serve U.S. interests. And from the perspective of United States, all they saw was strategic location and the place that they absolutely wanted to control and they still prize above everything else is Pu'uloa. Otherwise, people might know it as Pearl Harbor, but the original name was Pu'uloa, and it was a place of abundance for the people of Oahu. It was the food basket of Oahu. So you go from that kind of geography that had 28, some say up to 100 fish ponds, taro fields, just abundance, to now it's a giant Superfund site that's contaminated. That's the cost, right? That's what was taken from the people of Hawaii. And, you know, I think these lands that we're talking about now with the leases, they are... they're only part of the so-called ceded lands. These are the crown and government lands of the Hawaiian Kingdom that were taken. They're still in a kind of a trust category. Most of the military's land holdings in Hawaii, I calculate about 68% comes out of that public land trust. So it's a direct link to the events of the overthrow, the events of the U.S. so-called annexation and occupation of Hawaii. And that's where there's Native Hawaiians especially have a direct stake in the fate of those lands.
Let's talk about your governor, Josh Green, who says that he's in negotiations with the United States military. In fact, one of the quotes said that he didn't have time to be fighting the president. He had to engage in mature negotiations on behalf of the people of Hawaii. Green sent Army Secretary Dan Driscoll a proposal for a $10 billion plan that included so-called community benefits, and argued that this would be favorable, this sum, should the Army pursue condemnation, which is the use of eminent domain to seize Hawaii's land for national security. Basically, is an attempt to fast-track the leases. As an organizer, when I see the state move like that, I'm like, oh, you're trying to hurry up and get a concession in hopes that the people who are clearly organizing will go back inside. Can you talk about why fast-tracking the leases is problematic for folks? And some folks might be like, wow, that's $10 billion. That's great. Why is that still, yeah, a no-go?
Yeah, I mean, we have experience. This is not our first rodeo. You know, we fought for the return of our island of Koho'olawe, among other lands here. And it took, was it $4 billion for the cleanup? $400 million for cleanup was set aside when that land was returned. And, you know, there's a fraction of that land was actually cleaned up with that money. So the damage that's been done, the damage that continues to be done to this land, is there's no money that can compensate for that. You know, this is our future generations, our ability to live, our ability to grow food, that is compromised forever. You know, when they damage these lands and leave unexploded ordnance, when they use depleted uranium, which they said they never used, and so we're not interested in a payout. We want our land back. And so this fast tracking is problematic because we have processes in place to, you know, the environmental laws that are in place to have proper study, what are the impacts? And the military was proceeding through that process and failed. Their EIS, their environmental impact studies were deemed insufficient for at least a few of these leased areas. And then different branches of the military, so the Air Force, I believe, and other areas that the Army controls, they did not even submit their EISs and didn't even complete the process because for whatever reason, they didn't see that as a viable option for renewing or for getting new leases on those lands. So, you know, once the process and the laws didn't work for them, they went this other route of trying to pressure the state and the governor to try to come up with a deal. But as we probed and as we put pressure to find out what's, you know, how could this happen? How could condemnation happen by the end of last year? You know, I mean, even the U.S.'s own processes don't work that fast. And sure enough, it was determined, oh, we actually can't do that this year. And now it's a new effort for 2027 to come up with some kind of congressional package to do what's most likely going to be a land exchange, not a lease, with the state of Hawaii. And for us, oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to ask for clarity on what that would mean, land exchange versus lease.
Yes. So, I mean, I'll let Kyle speak to this more specifically, but basically, the lease process failed, or our new lease process failed. And so they're looking to exchange land in fee simple. So the military has lands that it would try to return or somehow trade with the state, and the state would allow them to continue to use these lease lands. But the switch would be that it would be in perpetuity because it would be fee simple instead of, you know, a time-bound lease.
Okay. One of the issues for the Army, well, there's a couple issues why they felt it was urgent to try to secure something. The time frame for negotiating a new lease is quite short at this point, and because they failed in the environmental impact statement process, they wanted to just abandon that process and just do some other workaround. The other problem is that because those lands are still under the jurisdiction of the state, they're zoned for conservation. And that means that live fire training, which they conduct at Pohakuloa, is in conflict with the land use designation. And so as long as it remains under the state's jurisdiction, the federal, they can't do all the stuff they wanna do. And so they wanna own it outright, which then federal law would trump the state law. There's a parcel that they acquired back in around 2009, I think. This was in an earlier wave of expansion that was happening after September 11. The army brought what they called a striker brigade. These were like 200 and something armored vehicles to Hawaii. We were fighting that. Camille was actually part of a lawsuit that fought against that because we said, you know, why are they bringing tanks to an island? What does that have to do with protecting anything? And how do you, you know, it made no sense. But what I think was actually the reason for it was to have a justification to acquire more land. So the army at that time acquired about 25,000 acres of land. After returning Kaho'olawe, which was about 28,000 acres, they acquired another 25,000. And they've been kind of banking it, I think. So they're looking at, on the island of Hawaii, this parcel of land, about 23,000 acres, 22,000 acres, in exchange for the leased parcel, which goes right along the road that crosses the saddle there. And this is where most of the military's infrastructure is. It's not the impact area, but it's where they fire from. And they want to control all of that and not have any conflicting land claims. So that's what that has been floated as an idea for a land swap. I don't know if it's legal because, again, these lands that are in question for the leases are part of this what's called the public land trust. And they go all the way back to the Hawaiian Kingdom lands that were designated as a trust. So the state doesn't even have a clear, you know, absolute title to it. They are the trustee for the beneficiaries. And so that raises all kinds of other questions about, you know, the legality of doing any kind of deals on this particular parcels of land.
I mean, that's why I wanted to start the conversation with the framework, right? So if we're using the framework that the U.S. is occupying these lands, then none of these conversations, none of what's being proposed is legal. The only thing that should happen is that land is given back to the Hawaiian people.
Cleaned up and returned.
Yeah, and so that's a good segue to where we're going next. Because so early last month, my friend Capone, I'm going to shout him out because he helped me get to all of you. He asked me to attend a meeting between community and military as an accomplice. We don't do allies around here, so accomplice. How can we connect struggles and be in support of the fight that's happening in Hawaii? Anyway, I was really, there were three reps there. I was really struck by how many I don't knows were given by the military personnel that was there. I mean, it was almost every question. The officers and the rank and file, whatever they call themselves, they get allowances. And the officers and above is like, it's like 4,200, 4,500, I'm saying numbers. And it's like 22,000 something for rank and file. I know someone that pays $6,000 a month in rent. And I was looking on, you know, so anyway, can continue about what this means for y'all.
Yeah, so it means landlords, you know, will raise their rent because they know that there are allowances that can afford that from the military families. And so it's already limited what is available for rental units in Hawaii. And to add that on top of it, it pushes our people out to the margins. And, you know, our own community, I'm here in Pu'ulo, and we have a large houseless community along the Pearl City bike path. Yeah. And it's right next to a lot of unused military land that is sitting there vacant, waiting for cleanup and waiting for plans to clean up for the last 25 years. And so that's just one impact. But what we learned during the Red Hill crisis, where the military's fuel facility in our region, it is at the edge of Pu'ulo, a fuel spill poisoned a major well and a major water area for all of Honolulu, not just Pu'ulo. What I learned living here and working here for the last 15 years is that the Army has their own water system to feed their bases, to service their families. And they use about 15 million gallons a day out of this region. And at the time, you know, the state, the county had to shut down about 5 wells in total between the county wells and the army wells that service this region, about 20% of Oahu's water. And where they made up that water from was Waiawa, which is the district that I'm in. And so about 100 million gallons a day are coming out of this small district that I'm in, plus the Army's 15 million gallons to service its own water system that services all across Pu'uloa or Pearl Harbor. And that water, those wells now have been shut down for, when was that, 2022? Yeah, 2022. And we don't know when those wells are going to be operable again. And so it's not just the water use that they are impacting, but also the water quality. And that's something that, you know, we may not be able to fully recover from. We don't know the impact, the full impacts yet. But, you know, once you get fuel in a water system, it's very difficult to then get that out. I mean, you're talking an underground porous lava rock that is where our fresh water sits, you know, for our future generations. And to have fuel contaminate probably the cleanest water, some of the cleanest water on the planet, is just devastating. And so, you know, that kind of impact and use, not just of our resources, but also the lack of care and the lack of cleanup and accountability on that is one of the reasons we're against the future use of our lands, the future holding of these lands, and refusal to even disclose what's happening on all of these lease lands. You know, in the environmental impact statements, it did not say what the current state of those lands is right now. And to me, you know, the whole point of an impact statement is, what is the use? How is it going to impact that land? What is the current state? And they said, well, as long as the federal government, as long as the military has control of these lands, they don't have to tell us that. It's only at some point if those lands need to be returned to the state, then they need to actually assess the condition and the cleanup that it will take to return those lands. So the truth is, we don't know their current condition. We don't know what it's going to take to clean them up. So how do you even put a value on that? We have no idea what that cost is going to be, but we know it's going to be immense, just the history and the years of use and abuse. But that's just a little bit.
Thank you, Camille.
And if I could jump back to the question about housing, because that's a huge issue in Hawaii. Of course, we're one of the most expensive places to live. And because of cost of land and housing and so forth. And I think this is a concern we've had for a long time about how the military economy drives some of that unaffordability of living here. So it goes back to when the military shifted from providing housing for service members to a neoliberal model of giving money to the service members that they could then spend either on base or off base. And the on base housing all have gone to private housing companies that have these long term 50 year leases, but they're guaranteed a certain level of income. So they've turned all these military members into consumers of housing, and they can now compete with the local residents in the private, you know, in the market for housing. And so it's had an inflationary effect. We've been asking for more accurate studies over the years, and only now we've started to see some of the analysts consider those kinds of effects and how it's causing displacement of Kanaka Maoli, Native Hawaiian residents, other people that can't afford to live here. So the housing problem is linked to probably these economics. The other thing I would say about the economics is that it's true, the military economy is a large part of our economy. It's like the second largest after tourism. But that dependency alone is a problem because it has created a certain kind of addiction almost to seeking that next fix without actually, you know, providing health and welfare for our communities. And so you've got certain people that take advantage of the cash flow that comes in with military spending. And so they do really well, but who's paying the price for that are Native Hawaiians whose stolen land is being used, and, you know, other communities that are outcompeted, right, in that military economy, who don't get the benefits and the trickle down that happens. So, you know, we need a process of transition to another kind of economy that also invests in our future and the things that we need, right, which includes things like addressing the problems of climate change and adaptation to that. Can we hire like our young people in a workforce that like goes everything from the researchers all the way to the workers who are, you know, helping to restore ecosystems and preventing landslides and floods and all of those kinds of things, right? We need all hands on deck addressing these kind of problems. And meanwhile, it's being diverted into wars that are burning up billions of dollars a day.
Yeah, we're about to wrap up. I'm going to give you a closing statement. So there is a conversation we didn't get to get into, but I hope you will come back because I want to continue to cover this. But there is this conversation about what would it look like for Hawaii to not be used for death and destruction, but rather the center for the world to learn about conservation, living with the land, things my daughter is studying that I don't even comprehend in my brain, and be the center. Right. To learn about living in peace, negotiating peace because of where it's strategically placed. So all those things are things I want to be able to unpack with you. There is a powerful land back movement in Hawaii. This is a powerful political moment. There is, to your point, Kyle, there's lots of horrible things happening. And we're seeing indigenous people all over the globe rise up to colonial powers everywhere. And so just if you could close on that thought, what is the potential of this moment to be different? Cal, I'm going to start with you, and Camille will end with you. And if you could do it in 60 seconds, my next guest would be so.
Yeah, I think behind me is a picture of from the island of Kahoolawe, which was a pico of the Hawaiian sovereignty movement began in the 1970s. Actually, this year is the 50th anniversary of the first group of nine people that landed in protests of the bombing of Kahoolawe, and they stopped the bombing in 1990, got the island back, and it's a continuing process of healing and restoration. But in the process, it seeded all these other struggles, including the largest sovereignty movement. So I think that Hawaii, from being a sort of a pivot, a fulcrum of American empire building, we can also be a pico of peace, a pico of a different vision of how we relate to our neighbors in the world.
For my listeners, Pico is center. Okay. Go ahead, Camille.
Yeah, I mean, we are an island, a tiny island in the middle of the Pacific. I mean, we're considered the most isolated place on the planet. So if our people could grow to over a million in population and be able to survive here, you know, with growing our own food, relying on our own systems, but also with in relationship with others, but fully self-sufficient here, then what lesson does that teach the rest of the world for how to survive in this, you know, planet, in this climate? We can do it. And what I always remind ourselves and everybody who comes here to Hanakehau is our little farm here in the belly of the beast, we call it. We are right in Pearl Harbor, right in Pu'uloa, is that these places still exist. We still have the potential to recover. We still have the potential to grow massive amounts of food to support our people if we remove the barriers and if we remove the ongoing assault from U.S. military, from other extractive industries here in Hawaii. And so these really are our places of hope, of recovery, of refuge. And if we can do it here in the most isolated place on the planet, in the midst of a huge military power, you know, in the world, we always say you can do it anywhere. I mean, we're survivors, and we hope to share that and build that with all the people who are fighting for the future of this planet and our future generations.
Well, and Kyle, mahalo for your time this morning. I hope to be able to meet you in person next time I am your way. Really appreciate y'all. Have beautiful days.
You too.
Thank you so much for having us. Aloha.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.